And hello, SunSouth listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means once again it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour I'll be reading picture books, and then the second half hour I'm going to begin a brand new novel titled Jack's New Power: Stories from a Caribbean Year. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Thwizzle Ping. And then it's What's Love All About, Minnie Moni. On a Mushroom Day, Bo Loves Books. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Windows to the World. So, it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Thwizzle Ping. This is a story of Lenny Fling, a boy who succeeded at everything, no matter the creation or concoction. For Lenny, failure was not an option. He recited poems in Latin and spoke fluent French. He read Steinbeck and admired Dame Judi Dench. When a problem arose, he was the first with a solution. He won a school medal for reducing air pollution. At recess, he ran faster than those in his heat. He'd gladly share if there wasn't enough to eat. If you don't love what's swimming in your fish stew, perhaps my homemade cheesy puffs will do. As the school year waned and winter turned to spring, Miss Simone reminded her class of an important thing. The music recital is coming up soon. Is everyone prepared to showcase a tune? Oh, no! Lenny felt a nervous lump in his throat. He couldn't sing a tune, play a chord, or hold a note. He scoured a garage sale and a second-hand store. Never mind learning to play, there was no instrument he could afford. When his parents arrived home from their double-shift day, they found the sitter snoozing and Lenny hiding away. They put their ears to his door and listened for a clue. Only the sound of silence as Lenny felt blue. Still, they persisted, but had no luck, until finally good fortune struck. Mom followed a song to the apartment downstairs. It was the groovalicious neighbor with the straggly nose hairs. Through the walls, they heard a symphonic clatter. The door opened to a woman holding a cymbal-shaped platter. Cookies or candy or carrots or cake, or perhaps carrots in a cake, I'm happy to bake. It was the world-famous musician Floretta Flynn. My sweet Lenny, you've grown. Please do come in. Mom was worried as Lenny became quiet. Since when did he not want cake in his diet? Let me see here, said Floretta Flynn. Why don't you leave us and I can listen to him? Floretta heard fear of the musical kind. She knew just the thing to ease Lenny's mind. Don't you worry, my dear, if you have nothing to say. Sitting here quietly is perfectly okay. Floretta grabbed a bucket from under her sink. She studied it for a moment and let herself think. Lenny, do you know what this is used for? Was this a trick question? Lenny couldn't be sure. It's for holding water or making mushroom stew. Floretta nodded. Yes, those are things buckets can do. But what if it were a drum? Wouldn't that be sweet? Perhaps you could use it to play a funky beat. Oh, no, Lenny said. Did you say beat? For me, playing music is no easy feat. Music is my greatest woe. Floretta smiled. Lenny, it's time to let that go. There's music inside that's waiting to sprout. We just need to have courage to let it flow out. Don't think about failure, just think about fun. And if you don't have the right instrument, you can make one. Floretta grabbed a gold record so Lenny could see. Do you think I played a real instrument on each one of these? The cheesy cheese grater, the vanilla fudge plates, the soapy dish opera, the blow dryer straights. These were not instruments I bought in a store. I made them myself from things I found in a drawer. Music's not just keys that you press. If you listen, you'll hear a rhythm beating right in your chest. A unique beat that only you can play. So tell me what you think your music should say. Lenny hit the bucket with a spatula in hand. But it didn't sound like drums in a rock and roll band. He grew impatient. How would he ever learn to shred? You must listen inside, said Floretta. Get out of your head. Lenny closed his eyes and listened for a sound. He let out an exhale and planted his feet on the ground. A rhythm came from within, so loud it filled the room. It was the beat of his heart. Boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. Lenny ran to his apartment in 2 seconds flat. Mom, Dad, I need your salt and pepper shakers stat. Lenny's parents looked at each other, no longer concerned. They could see that their spirited son had returned. Lenny rummaged through the cupboard, and under the sink, he grabbed cranberry cans and pens filled with ink. A quiet hum filled the space of the living room. Lenny listened, then thump, dee, dee, dump, dee, dee, boom. Have you given a name to this musical thing? Lenny looked at his mom. How about Thwizzle Ping? It'll make you dance. It'll make you sing. Yes, that's it. I'll call it Thwizzle Ping. In the school auditorium during the recital hour, kids played their instruments with roaring power. When Lenny was called, he took the stage front and center. All the kids were confused when he entered. Lenny sat up nervously in front of the crowd. Then he remembered music of the heart is worth sharing and needs to be played loud. I'm Lenny Fling. This is my Thwizzle Ping. Lenny played with such vigor in the beat he lost all control. Everyone was so inspired to hear such spunky rock and roll. How did you build such a harmonious, fantabulous thing? Look in your drawers and cupboards, and you too can build your own Thwizzle Ping. Everyone wanted an instrument for the next show. Lenny was happy to help, for music was no longer his foe. Stevie Slop, find meatloaf and a lamb chop. Windy Hay, grab a spoon and an ice cube tray. Lucy Miggle, we'll call the jelly bean jar jiggle. You never know what shape a glorious instrument will take. So tell me, what kind of music will you make? What's love all about, Minnie Moni? Hi, my name's Monica, but everyone calls me Minnie Moni. I love painting, eating spaghetti with tomato sauce, and going for a walk with my dog, Max. I don't like broccoli, not at all, nor boredom, nor people who don't pick up their dog's poop. Max understands me very well as I understand him. Grown-ups, however, I don't always understand. For example, when they talk about a thing called love. Love can't be seen, nor smelled, nor touched. It can't even be painted, so how do they know what it is? It is said that love can move mountains. Wow, love must be very big and very strong then. Much stronger than me. But It also said that love is delicate and can be found in the little things. Well, which is it? Is love big or small? Make up your mind already. One day, I heard in a song about how love is in the air. I certainly don't see it in the air, but I like the idea. And there's another song that says, love is everywhere, but I don't see it anywhere. It must be hiding. I've also heard that love should be watered like a seed if you want it to grow. So, it's a plant now. Love also supposedly means you adore someone or something. So does that mean I'm in love with spaghetti? I don't get it, Max. None of this makes any sense, does it? Now that I think about it, though, hugging makes me feel good. Maybe love has to do with that. Or does it have to do with kissing? Hundreds of kisses. Meow. She's holding the cat. Thousands of kisses. Millions of kisses. Or maybe love just means being kind to people. Or taking care of important things. What if love is just sharing really special moments? And saying it out loud. I love you, little plant. I love you, strawberry cream cupcakes. I love you, bicycle. I love you, little rabbit. That's it. Now it makes sense. Maybe all these things together are love. And if so, Max, can you imagine filling the whole world with love? Because I sure can. On a mushroom day. On a mushroom day, the forest floor springs a little under your footsteps. Rain has come, and the ground holds it like a sponge, feeding the plants and fungi. On a mushroom day, you may hear birds calling through the canopy, and the high pitch of mosquitoes. You might even hear yourself sing a little mushroom song. On a mushroom day, you might smell apricots or maple syrup or other more mysterious aromas wafting from the forest floor. On a mushroom day, some brilliantly colored beans will catch your eyes. Teeny tiny red ones and big blue ones dripping bright droplets. Once you start to see them, you can't help but notice more and more. A mushroom is like the fruit of a fungus, as a tomato that grows on a vine. Most of the fungus live underground or inside stumps of old trees, as webs of finest thread call mycelium. On a mushroom day, you might never see mycelium, but you know it's there, woven all through the woods. The many types of mushrooms above are little reminders of the enormous life underfoot, connecting the trees, feeding the forest, and binding us all together. On a mushroom day, you could find chickens perched on a log, hedgehogs hiding under the leaves, or a lion's mane springing from a tree. On a mushroom day, you could spot some spooky dudes, jack-o'-lanterns that glow in the night, and angels with ghostly veils. Beware. On a mushroom day, you might find an elf's cup or a dryad's saddle. You might even dance when you discover a fairy ring. On a mushroom day, you'll want to stop a lot to stoop, stretch, and study as you make your way through the woods. Take your time. Give your attention. Remember, a mushroom day isn't any old day. Most mushrooms disappear as quickly as they come, and you never know when they'll pop up again. On a mushroom day, you'll discover a whole quindrum of odd and wondrous fungi, most of which will stay right there in the forest enjoying their day in the dappled sun. But if you're very lucky on a mushroom day, you may take home a treasure or two, leaving most for other searchers. Then, on a mushroom night, after a long mushroom day, you might just taste something wonderful indeed. Boo loves books. Everyone in Miss Spinelli's class liked reading. Everyone except Phoebe. "Phoebe, the book basket is that-a-way," said Miss Spinelli. "I know," Phoebe said, "but I like to go the long-a-way." Phoebe worried when she didn't know the sound of a letter, and letters that were joined together made her freeze. When Phoebe knew a word, she stayed quiet in case she got it wrong. A little later, Miss Spinelli made an announcement. "No reading at school tomorrow," Phoebe whooped inside. "Instead, we'll be reading somewhere special. Be at school early. We're taking the bus." Phoebe's tummy went flip, flop, flip. That feeling lasted all day, then followed her home. "I'll be sick tomorrow," said Phoebe. "Are you sick now?" asked her mom. "A little, but I'll be much worse in the morning." "Tomorrow will be a good day, Phoebe. You'll see." The next day, Phoebe climbed onto the bus. She sat with her friend, Harriet, and stared out the window as the bus rumbled along. Then Harriet jumped up. "The animal shelter," said Harriet. Phoebe frowned. "This isn't a place to read books." "Every place is a place to read books," said Miss Spinelli. "Everyone follow the keeper," said Miss Spinelli. Phoebe squeezed Harriet's hand as they shuffled past rows of yipping, yapping dogs. Then they stopped. Miss Spinelli explained how each child would read to a dog. Phoebe was already worried about reading, and she didn't know much about dogs. What a terrible day! "This is your dog, Phoebe. His name is Big Boo." Clutching a picture book, Phoebe followed Miss Spinelli inside. Phoebe stared at Big Boo. Big Boo stared at Phoebe. When he moved, Phoebe froze. "I want to go home," she whispered. "I'm staying right here," said Miss Spinelli. "This dog is a little bit scared, but he would never hurt you." "Scared," thought Phoebe, "of me?" "Talk about the pictures," said Miss Spinelli. "Your voice is all he needs." Phoebe got comfortable, then slowly opened the book. There are twinkling stars and a big red pirate ship ready to sail the seas. Phoebe watched Big Boo pick up his blanket. "Pirate monkeys," Phoebe gulped as Big Boo stepped closer. "They're fighting over treasure." She could see Big Boo's skin where hair had once grown, a rubbery mouth with a droop, and eyes not scary, but soft. "Maybe you escaped from a pirate monkey ship. Is that what happened to you, Big Boo?" Phoebe kept reading. When she got stuck, Big Boo didn't mind one bit. But before Phoebe finished the book, Big Boo picked up his blanket and plodded to the back of his room. "Why did he do that?" Phoebe asked Miss Spinelli. "Well, he's used to people coming and going," said Miss Spinelli. Phoebe looked at Big Boo. She realized they were both scared of things. "Miss Spinelli, do you have a book about dogs?" Phoebe opened the book. "I'm staying right here, Big Boo. You'll see." Phoebe read in her best voice and didn't care if she got words wrong. She just wanted Big Boo to come back. And he did. One day at school, not long after, Phoebe announced, "This is my new dog, Big Boo. He's the best listener in the world. He loves books about dogs, and so do I. Windows to the World. My no-no is getting old. Not dinosaur old, but almost. These days, he's wobbly on the ladder. He totters under the weight of thick albums. And he strains his eyes through his magnifying glass. Looking after stamps is a big responsibility. Monday to Saturday, Nono sorts through his gazillion stamps. But I love Sundays best because there's no sorting to do. Aren't these wonderful, Alexander? Come. Stamps are windows to the world. Every stamp has a story to tell. Tell me a stamp story, Nono. Which one? You know which one. I snuggle into Nono. He clears his throat and begins. Well, the world's very first stamp was the penny black. It was the first day of May, 1840, back when messages were still sent by carrier pigeon or on horseback. Sir Rowland Hill, schoolmaster inventor of the adhesive postage stamp, 1837. The heavier the package, the more stamps were needed. Before stamps, messages were placed in tiny tubes and tied to a pigeon's back or claws. More people began using envelopes to mail letters. The first stamp, the penny black. We leaf through the crinkly pages of his albums. Well, these will be yours someday, Alexander. When you have something special, it's good to share, he says, patting me on the shoulder. I think I know what someday means because it makes me feel all wiggly inside. And there's another thing. I don't want to hurt Nono's feelings, but what if I don't want to be a collector? When my school teacher mentions the Philatelic Museum, I ask Nono whether he knows about it. Of course, it's the home, the heaven of stamps. It's impossible not to love the quiet dignity of it, the musty smell of printed paper, the gleaming vitrines, the tickling of the temperature gauges on the walls. I have no idea what Nono is talking about. But when Nono takes me there, I understand. Inside, it's neither too hot nor too cold. Stamps are safe and snug behind glass. Friendly guards smile in every room. And here, everyone can enjoy them, not just me. We even get to meet the curator. And when she asks about his stamps, Nono glows. That's when I have an idea. Sadly, Nono doesn't like it. It isn't sharing with me and sharing with the world. This isn't sharing with me and sharing with the world the same thing, I say, patting his shoulder. Nono gathers his albums and hides. I doubt Nono's teacher ever talked about sharing in school. Imagine your precious stamps sitting alongside our museum collection's penny black, I read to a closed door. But Nono still won't come out. When you have something special, it's good to share, I whisper through the keyhole. Finally, I hear Nono's slippers shuffle and his door clicks open. Now that Nono's stamps have found a home at the Philatelic Museum, Monday to Saturday, Nono runs guided tours. He no longer strains his eyes, totters under thick albums, or wobbles on ladders. But I love Sundays best because that's when he runs tours with me. We delight crowds with the penny black story. And after Nono says, stamps are windows to the world. I don't miss a beat. Every stamp has a story to tell. Now both our names are spelled in golden letters next to the word philatelist. How am I a philatelist? I ask. Well, a philatelist is someone who looks after stamps. Like you, I ask. And you, Alexander, he says, patting my shoulder. When you have something special, I chime in. It's good to share. Okay, and here's some fun facts about the penny black, the world's first stamp. Why is it so well known? Well, the penny black is the world's first adhesive or self-sticking stamp. It features the profile of Queen Victoria, who ruled when the penny black was invented. This stamp revolutionized the sending of mail. How? It made it simple. It allowed for all letters weighing up to 14 grams to be sent anywhere at the flat rate of one penny. This prepayment method proved so popular that writing letters became the new form of communication. Why its nickname? Well, the penny black is black in color, and its monetary value is one penny, British currency. This stamp has straight edges and no serrations, lace-like edges. Why? Those had not been invented yet. When was it first used? Well, the penny black was issued on the 1st of May, 1840. Before 1840, messages were sent by carrier pigeon or on horseback, and whoever received the mail paid for its postage on a distance-traveled per-sheet basis. This made calculating postage complicated. Why does it state the country of origin? All stamps state where they are from, except for British stamps. Why? It's a special privilege awarded to Britain because Britain is where stamps were invented. British stamps always bear a silhouette of the current monarch. The profile of Queen Elizabeth II was used on British stamps until her passing in 2022. Here's a beginner's guide to stamp collecting. What to collect? You can start building your stamp collection around your interest and what you are passionate about. What tools may be useful? Well, a magnifying glass to examine your stamps in detail. Albums for sorting and storage. Ideally, all stamps should be stored somewhere dark and dry to avoid damage due to mold, sunlight, and humidity. Where can stamps be found? Well, mailboxes. Look through the letters and parcels you receive through the post and check if there are any stamps on them before discarding the envelopes or packages. Friends and family. Ask your friends and family to help you collect stamps. This way, you can collect stamps from all over the world. I regularly cut them out of used envelopes and packages I receive in the post, taking extra care not to damage the serrations. I keep them aside for my father in an old biscuit tin. Here's a note about this story. Alice's father, a philatelist, started collecting stamps as a child after the Second World War. He scrimped, swapped, and saved for 60 years until his collection spanned several continents and cultures. When his entire collection was stolen, Alice's son wondered why he hadn't shared it with the world. This innocent comment inspired Alice to write this story. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to begin a brand new novel that I'm super excited about because this is a book written by one of my all-time favorite children's authors, Jack Gantos. And the name of this book is Jack's New Power, Stories from a Caribbean Year. Jack Henry, the hero of Heads or Tails, Stories from the Sixth Grade, is back. It is the summer after sixth grade, and Jack and his offbeat family have relocated to the island of Barbados. Jack hopes he's escaping the craziness of his old life in Florida, but even in a Caribbean paradise, he is plagued by missed adventure. He gets a violent case of blood poisoning and ends up painted purple from head to toe, discovers the perils of male bonding in a pepper-eating contest with his father, and has his heartstrings twanged by an older woman, his sister's best friend, to name just a few of his troubles. But in these eight fierce and funny stories, Jack always perseveres, sometimes with the help of one of the few reliable things in his life, his trusty diary. Dynasty. We were not allowed to swim in the ocean far below the Edgewater Hotel because we were on the rough side of the island, the windward side, Dad had called it. It was rugged and gusty, and the blue waves arrived in towering rows all the way from Africa. They glided across the ocean like a conquering navy and crashed against the shore, which was fortified with huge skull-shaped boulders crowned with spikes of sharp rock. These waves kept coming, but Barbados didn't budge an inch. I figured if a wave even hurled me against one of those prickly skulls, I'd be gutted like the fish we had been eating for dinner each night. There were small inlets of pink sandy beach, as smooth and soft as slices of melon, but signs everywhere warned about the undertow. And we had been lectured by Dad against going down the steps carved into the face of the coral rock to play on the beach. Just to make sure we wouldn't get near the ocean, he told us the story of the two German girls. He gathered us on the wooden balcony overlooking the shore. The wind was briny with salt spray and blew our hair and clothes to one side so that we looked like the small twisted trees bent toward the land. "Come here," he hollered to the three of us. We huddled around him and watched his every move. He pulled up on the crease of his cream pants leg and lifted his brown shoe onto the lower rung of the balcony. I did the same. Pete did what I did. Betsy looked impatient and scratched a mosquito bite on her ankle. He removed a cigarette from his case and tapped the filter against the face of his watch. Then, in one quick motion, he snapped open his lighter and shielded the flame with his free hand as he drew in a breath so deep his cheeks pressed against his teeth and bones like a mummy. Dad was warming up to telling a really good story. "All Germans can read English," he started and raised a finger to mark his point. But the girls ignored the red warning signs and were swept out to sea by the undertow. He pointed to the breakers, which slapped and fanned over the beach, then receded to the bottom of the following wave. Still, they got a second chance. A Canadian father and son were on the shore and spotted them as they desperately waved their arms for help. "Stick with me," the father said to his son. They bravely dove into the water, but the son couldn't keep up. They never reached the girls, and the girls never reached the shore. The father was also dragged out to sea. Only the son was washed back onto the beach. You can imagine just how that boy felt for not staying by his father's side. I did imagine. He would have dropped to his knees on the shore and pounded his chest with his fist while the waves washed up over him. Somehow, I figured, the father was punished because the son was weak. I promised to do everything my father asked of me, Never again would I lie or cheat or misbehave. I'd be strong and brave and smart. I looked over at Pete. He had covered his eyes with one hand. I could tell he was thinking the same thing I was. Stick with Dad. Don't let him down. Dad continued. Well, a week later, what was left of the three bodies washed ashore on Crane Beach, some 12 miles away. The sharks had gotten to them first, then the crabs. You can just imagine how horrid they were, he whispered, and gazed dreamily out to sea. They looked like bloated lepers. He took a quick pull on his cigarette, then flicked it over the balcony. The wind blew it back against the cliff. He bowed his head in respect for the dead. I think they get the message, Mom piped, in just as I was forming a spongy, rotting picture of bloated lepers in my mind. She had crept up on us for the gruesome ending. I stared at the maroon paisley scarf she had fixed around her head to keep her hair in place. With the spooky mood I was in, each paisley design looked like a thick dollop of blood. Dad snapped out of his daze and curled his arm around Mom's waist. We'll be in the lounge if you need us, he announced with a sudden new energy. The lesson was over. You all play by the pool, Mom ordered. Betsy, keep an eye on the boys. You know how they get. That was one of the differences between Mom and Dad. Dad could get us worked up to do anything he wanted by telling us a lesson story with a tragic ending. Mom just went right to the point and told us what to do. Even though she was pushier, he was more convincing. Pete and I ran up to our room. We didn't have to share it with Betsy, who was stuck with a baby. This meant we could wrestle and make all the noise we wanted and sneak out at night to raid the bar for bottles of lemon soda. We had been living at the Edgewater Hotel for a week. Dad had flown down from Fort Lauderdale a month before us. When we joined him, our house wasn't ready, so he checked us into the Edgewater because it was close to where he was fixing up a large private track club called the Roundhouse. He took us to see it. It was the most beautiful building I'd ever seen. It was pure white and sparkled with diamond dust plaster, as Dad put it. The walls were round as cake, and it had an orange tin roof as tall and pointy as a party hat. There was a little red flag in the shape of a horse sticking out the top. The driveway gravel was pink and reminded me of candy hearts. I picked up a piece and licked it. If it had tasted sweet, it would prove we were living in a fairy tale. It tasted like clean dust, and I spit it out. It really didn't bother me that we weren't living in a fairy tale. Living on Barbados was pretty close. We threw our clothes off and pulled our new bathing trunks up over our skinny white legs. After we knotted the drawstring inside our waistbands, we ran down to the pool. Betsy had settled on a lounge chair to read a book. The baby was asleep in his carriage under a striped umbrella with fringe around the edges. Pete and I gathered up a garden hose, a big rock, and my swim mask. We were playing a game we called Deep Sea Diver after a movie we had seen in the television room. I was a diver and Pete was my air pump and support crew. Anyone who dove into the pool would be a giant squid. If they touched me, I was strangled to death. I put on my mask, snuck one end of the hose in my mouth, picked up the rock, and jumped into the deep end. I held my breath and sank to the bottom. I exhaled out of the corner of my mouth and watched the silver and blue bubbles go all the way up to the blurry surface. Then I breathed through the hose. It worked. There was air flowing through. I exhaled and took a deep breath. Then I held the hose with my right hand and tugged on it twice. That was the signal. In a moment, I could taste lemon soda mixed with some funky inner hose scum. Then there was more soda and more. I needed to breathe. I pulled on the hose. The soda slowed to a trickle, then stopped. This was great. I could have stayed there the entire day. Pete could feed me olives, raisins, and little Vienna sausages, all washed down with my new favorite soda, lemon squash. I was thinking that the air was getting a little thin, and it would be a good idea if we had a bicycle pump to hook onto the hose so Pete could pump fresh air to me. Suddenly, the hose was jerked out of my mouth, and I swallowed a lungful of water. I pushed the rock to one side and sprang up toward the surface. "Why'd you do that?" I sputtered. "Come quick," Pete said, and, prancing up and down on his toes as if he had to pee, "Dad's drowning!" I dragged myself up over the stone edge of the pool and grabbed a towel as we ran toward the lounge. No one was inside. They were all out on the back balcony, peering down toward the rocks and rolling ocean, and pointing at two tiny heads bobbing up and down over the huge swells. I could tell right away that with each passing wave, they were drawn closer and closer to the prickly rocks. In a few minutes, they'd be dead, pinned to the sharp spikes, like prize butterflies. I also knew that neither of them was Dad, but he wasn't even in the water yet. He was running across the beach. Without slowing, he pulled his shirt over his head, kicked off his shoes, unbuckled his trousers, and hopped out of them, and waded into the water. He dove forward and began to swim. His arms and legs kicked up white water as he raced to reach the couple before they struck the rocks. It was going to be close. "He's going to die," Betsy screamed. She was scared and angry. "Stop him! He's insane!" "He'll be okay," Mom said, and took a deep breath. She stood behind Betsy and held her shoulders. "He's a good swimmer." He was. When we had lived on Cape Hatteras, he swam in the ocean all the time, right next to the signs warning everyone about the undertow. I was small then and thought undertow meant that if you stuck your toe into the water, you got pulled under and drowned. It wasn't quite like that. What it meant was that if you were swimming close to the shore, a current of water could pull you straight out to sea and keep you from swimming back in. Well, it didn't pull you under, but eventually you got tired and drowned. I knew there was only one way to beat an undertow. Once it carried you out to sea, you had to swim parallel to the shoreline for a while and then head in to the beach. That way, you swam beyond the control of the undertow current and lived to tell about it. "He knows what he's doing," I said to Pete. "Watch him." Pete covered his eyes and peeked between his fingers. He still hadn't learned to swim and was terrified of the water. "He's not even getting tired," I said, elbowing Pete. "Keep your eyes open. You'll learn something." Just then, Betsy fell out of Mom's grip and slumped to the floor. As soon as she landed on her rear, she hopped up and started screaming and swinging her arms. "She's hysterical," said the bartender. "I'll get her a brandy." He ran off and returned with a golden drink and poured it down her throat. She spit most of it right out. But it worked. She stood on her own 2 feet and stopped struggling. Mom stroked her hair and quietly whispered in her ear. Someone brought a blanket and draped it over her shoulders. Dad was still going strong. He swam up the swells, then down into the gullies, then up again, until he had almost reached them. And then he stopped. They were about 20 feet from the neck of an enormous rock with points as sharp as swords. All around its base was a circle of foam where the waves had surged up against it and angrily slid down. He wanted to calm the couple before making his move. He made a lot of hand gestures, then went forward with his plan. He swam up to the woman, turned her onto her back, and held her across the chest before she could struggle. Once he got her into position, he did a side stroke and slowly angled down the beach and away from the undertow. The man followed. Stroke by stroke, they pulled away from the rocks as the swells curled beneath them. A group of men and women scurried down the steps to the beach, forming a human chain into the water. "Can I go too?" I asked Mom. "No," she replied. "You kids stay up here with me." Dad had also told us all another true ocean story. Two children and their parents were on a small sailboat in a storm. The wife was hit by the swinging boom and knocked overboard. She went straight down into the dark water. The father tried to jump overboard to save her, but the children grabbed him and held him back. They could live with one missing parent, but not two. They would never know if the father could have saved the mother. Mom didn't want to lose more than one, but she wouldn't have to. Dad had gone far enough down shore and had turned toward the beach. There was no undertow running against him. The waves carried him forward. The swells turned into breakers, and they rode in as if on white horses. The chain of people grew longer, and in a minute they had him, then the woman, then the man. Two men dragged Dad ashore, where he sat slumped forward, with his head resting between his knees. Finally, once he got his breath back, he looked up at us and waved. We waved back wildly. I was so proud of him. He was a hero. No one else risked his life to save that couple. Even if someone had, he would have drowned. But Dad was fearless. I knew I couldn't have done what he did. But since he was my dad, it was almost the same thing. After all, I was named after him. I was a chip off the old block. If he could do it, I could do it. A circle of men and women gathered around him and helped him to his feet. Then the entire procession climbed the steps and appeared up over the cliff. Betsy threw off her blanket and ran at him with her arms open. He picked her up and swung her over his head, then back to the floor, where she pressed her face into his chest. Pete and I took a hand each as Mom kissed his face and smoothed his hair. "Drinks for everyone," Dad announced, his eyes flashing around the room. He was in good spirits. He pulled his hand from my grasp and swung around to point at the couple he saved. They were gone. Everyone fanned out to find them, but they had vanished. I stared out at the ocean to see if they had gone back in. Maybe they wanted to drown themselves, like mysterious lovers who throw themselves off a cliff. "Well, whoever they are," Dad said with a quick laugh, "put it all on their bill." Everyone cheered. By the end of the evening, the only thing we knew about the couple was that they were British, were on their honeymoon, and, as Dad put it, were as dumb as dirt for swimming in water that could flip a battleship. In the morning, they had checked out. 2 days later, we were sitting at dinner when the waiter brought Dad a cable. He ripped the envelope down the side and removed the message. "Well, what do you know?" he said after a moment. "I saved some British royalty." "Let's see," Betsy said, squealing, and snatched the cable from his hand. "Read it out loud," said Mom. "Sorry to have run off. Stop, couldn't have. Press involved. Stop. Every member of our family thanks you and your family. Stop. When in England, contact Lord and Lady Jeffreys, Duke and Duchess of Sussex. Stop. 01-704-9776. Eternally grateful." She lowered the cable and sighed. "Now that is what I call a happy ending," Dad said. "Mom didn't think so. I call it rude," she pinched in. She was still annoyed because Dad had risked his life and they didn't have the manners to say thank you to his face. "Can we call the number?" Betsy asked. "We'll see," Dad replied. "I'd love to be British," Betsy said, swooning. "They are so great. Every family has so much history to them, like the Duke of Marlborough, or the Viceroy of Firth, or the Duchess of Windsor. And then there's us, the Henrys family. Now, that does not sound like greatness." "Wait a minute," Dad cut in. "We're Americans, and we build great families the American way." Betsy raised her eyebrows. "And how might that be?" "First," he replied, "Americans don't have royal families. We have business families, political dynasties, powerhouse sports families. Americans don't have to be born into greatness. We can make ourselves great. That's the American way." Betsy smirked. "The American way is nothing but a rat race. I'd rather win the lottery and move to Europe." I was staying out of this discussion. Somehow, I knew it would lead to something bad. I stared up at the dining room walls. Just below the ceiling beams were a series of British coats and arms in the shape of little shields. On the shields were pictures of lions and eagles and fearless men and armor and words such as honor, courage, wisdom. The British used to own Barbados and had left a lot of their old stuff behind once the island gained independence. It would be neat, I thought, to have a Henry family coat of arms. Dad's voice became louder. "All great families begin their road to greatness by facing their fears. So that's how we'll begin." Suddenly, he pointed his butter knife at my nose. "Jack, what's your greatest fear?" My mouth was filled with a huge chunk of bread. Mom, Betsy, Pete turned to look at me. I couldn't say a word. I just chewed and chewed. For a moment, I thought my greatest fear was choking to death. "Take your time," Dad said warmly, giving me room. "Dig deep inside yourself and think of something that gives you the shivers, really makes you break out in a cold sweat and want to run away like a coward. Well, come on, time's up. What's it going to be?" I swallowed hard. "Horses?" I managed to mutter. "Huh? Speak up," Dad insisted, leaning closer. "Don't be so afraid that you can't even say it." I took a quick sip of water and swallowed. "Horses?" I said. "I'm afraid of horses." Dad made a face. "Is that it?" "Yeah," I replied. "I'm afraid of being kicked by a horse." "Well, that's a beginning," he said. "Once you get over that, we'll move on to something more important." He turned toward Pete. I sighed and thought of standing behind a horse and having it kick me on the forehead with a 10-pound steel shoe attached to its deadly back hoof. Just the thought of it made my shoulders flinch. Pete had taken advantage of the 2 minutes it took me to ruin myself. "Water?" he blurted out and started to twist his face up in a panic. "I can't swim." "Well, we'll fix that," Dad announced and waved his fork as though it were a magic wand. I half expected Pete to jump up, run across the dining room to the patio, dive into the pool, and swim like a dolphin. "Betsy," Dad said, "let's hear it." "Okay," she replied. She had used the time to organize exactly what was on her mind. "I'm afraid I'll call the number on this cable and they'll ask me who I am and who I know and who were my ancestors. And I'll tell them we are the Henry family and they'll reply, 'Henry, are you servants? We don't recall any Henry family.' And they'll hang up because we are a bunch of nobodies." There was a long pause while Dad leaned back in his chair. He gazed up at the ceiling and breathed deeply, then more deeply. It seemed as though all the air in the room, the curtains, the tablecloth corners, the little table flowers, all nodded toward his flaring nostrils. After a moment, he exhaled and looked Betsy directly in the eyes. "We are not a bunch of nobodies," he said. "I know we're starting over here, and we don't have some long family history filled with snotty blue bloods. But that's not what is important. We are a family at the beginning of greatness. All those British royalty had to come from somewhere. At some point, they were living in caves, wearing animal skins, and beating each other with sticks. So big deal. They've had a head start on us. Now, they're at the butt end of their empire, and we are at the beginning of ours. And for my money, I'd rather be part of something new and great than be some royal has-been." "Honey," Mom whispered, "keep her voice down. We don't want to cause a scene." There were a lot of British guests at the hotel. Betsy lowered her head. She had taken it too far. There were times when she could beat him in an argument, but there were also times when he reared back and let her have it. He had just nailed her. "So," he said, wrapping up his point, "you can face your fear and give them a call." I felt like an idiot for revealing my fear of horses. A call would be easy to make. I should have said I had a fear of something like spending money. Then Dad could give me a bundle and let me face my fear by letting me go on a spending spree. And unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. I want to thank all the listeners, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the fascinating novel titled Jack's New Power, Tales from a Caribbean Year. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.